The topic of my session today, as you can see, is Keynes and Hayek, head-to-head, and a little cozier meeting here with another group upstairs. So let me just ask, for starters, how many have had at least an intro course, college course, in macroeconomics? Let's see. Okay, a whole bunch of it. So you know about the Keynesian cross and all that. I'm going to use the Keynesian cross quite a bit today, but I could use the more elaborate versions, ISLM analysis, aggregate supply, aggregate demand. In fact, it's interesting to note that the criticisms I'll make of Keynes today show up even in just the simple model, aggregate or the Keynesian cross. And so the result I get is not because of using the simplest of the simple Keynesian models. I call this an application of capital-based macroeconomics. And I want to put Keynes and Hayek together head to head. Now, they debated one another. I put debate in quotes because it wasn't much of a debate. The debate consisted largely of each one trashing the other's book, okay? That doesn't quite conform to the standards of debate. So I think we can get at it more carefully if we look at the two theoretical constructions and see how they differ. And here's what I want you to watch for, because here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to lay out the Keynesian model compared to the Hayekian model, and eventually I'll take the Keynesian model and relax three assumptions, three critical assumptions. And I don't think anyone will object to relaxing these assumptions. You'll see what they are eventually. And once you relax them, then the Keynesian model morphs into the Hayekian model. So that's the exercise. That's what we're ultimately going for. Now, it's really not as hard as you think to put these two head to head. You know, there they are. Little-known photograph. But the debate soon ended, really in despair. Hayek was in despair. He couldn't persuade Keynes of even the most basic elements. Keynes won mainly on political grounds and not on economic grounds. And it's been that way ever since. You know, Keynes comes to life every time the economy's in bad trouble and some politician is trying to think of something to do. It's always a Keynesian kind of a thing. Now, if you've had macro at the intro level, you have an idea of what that Keynesian vision is, but I want to spell it out here and contrast it just generally with the Hayekian vision. Keynes' vision of the economy suggests a circular flow, you've all been used to that, in which earning and spending are brought into balance by changes in the level of income and employment. So it's not movements in wages and prices and interest rates that get you the equilibrium. It's spiraling up and spiraling down of the economy, adjusting income until the economy is in equilibrium. The contrast to that, Hayek's vision of the economy suggests a means-ends framework. And there's your contrast there, circular flow as opposed to means-ends. In which the means of production are transformed over time. So you've got the temporal element in on the ground floor of the vision into consumable output. Now, it turns out that graphically, the circular flow shows up as a Keynesian cross. We can get over that hump pretty easily and see how that works. And the cross's intersection, it identifies a particular state of the economy, meaning really the level of income and hence the level of employment. Income and expenditures being in balance at that point. And with Hayek, the vision, of course, the graphics are different. It's a Hayekian triangle, and the triangle is shape depicting the intertemporal pattern of investment. In equilibrium, the pattern of investment corresponds to the intertemporal preference of consumers. So the equilibration is in terms of the interest rate and in terms of matching that structure of production with intertemporal preferences, saving preferences, we could say, of people in the economy. Okay, now I'm going to do a brief review of this Keynesian circular flow and you've seen it in all your textbooks. We have business organizations, which is just a shell. It's a facility to allow workers and investors to interact. Down below, we have all the people. We have workers who are also consumers and investors who are also consumers. Down below, we haven't got any circle yet, but we can start one. So there's part of the circular flow, which shows a flow of labor and other factor services. That expression, other factor services, is sort of a minor tag to Keynes's theory. He really thinks in terms of labor. He argues as if labor is the only factor, or at least the representative factor, and other factors of production behave similar to labor, right? So he doesn't really distinguish that well or that often between the different factors. It's all labor, all right? And, of course, they get paid for it. It's called income. So now you've got half of the circular flow. The other half is that the business organizations facilitate the production of output, goods and services, which is bought by these people at the bottom, either investors who are buying machinery and that kind of thing, or consumers who are buying consumer goods. They have to pay for it, and that's the expenditures, like so. All right, expenditures, consumption plus investment. Now, I'm not going to bring the interest rate in here, except the way it's brought in today's application of Keynesianism as a policy tool. You know, what's Bernanke going to do with the interest rate? You're going to raise it, lower it, and so on. Can't lower it much further than it is now. So we'll bring in the Federal Reserve as the implementer of policies. And when I first drew that part of the diagram, I made that 2% at the right look exceedingly low. It doesn't look too low today. We're down to 0%. I guess I need to revise this thing. And, well, let's get the economy going. It's turned off now. My circular flow actually circulates. It doesn't do that in the textbook, but it circulates. But it's not circulating very fast. Why is it not circulating very fast? Because the interest rate's at 6%, okay? If you wanted to circulate faster, move the interest rate down, and it'll circulate faster, okay? And so the interest rate, of course, you're pumping a lot of money out, and you get inflation. If you're worried about inflation, well, move the interest rate back up, and you get a slower economy, okay? That's the way it tends to work, okay? Yeah, let's get rid of that. Now, there's Keynes and then Hayek. And Hayek, of course, has the means-ends framework, which is that Hayekian triangle. And the interest rates in play here, not as a policy tool, but as a regulator of that structure of production, keeping it in line with people's savings preferences, whatever they happen to be. And if there's a increase in saving, then you're going to get, well, there's the goods flowing through the structure. If there's an increase in savings, you're going to get a readjustment of that production process and a more elongated production structure, more stages of production, and faster growth accommodates an increase in savings and so on. So we've got quite a bit of morphing to do. How do we get from circular flow to the Hayekian triangle and all that? And that's what we're going to do today. In Keynesian equilibrium, as you know, you've taken the course, Y equals E, income equals expenditure. Y means income. It's not that economists can't spell, although many of them can, I've learned, but it's that little I is interest and big I is investment. Okay, so income becomes Y. And I'm just working with a wholly private economy, which is to say I'm not putting government expenditures and taxes into the picture. I've learned lecturing to Auburn sophomores that it's good to write that word, wholly private economy, because some of the Tea Partiers think I mean H-O-L-Y. No, just no government spending and no taxes, at least for the time being. So Y equals C plus I. Okay, that's the story. And you remember the graph we put it on, expenditures on the vertical axis, income on the horizontal, and that 45-degree line just shows locations where the two halves of that circular flow are equal, where income equaled expenditures. If they're unequal, then funny things are happening in the economy. You've got more being produced than is being purchased, or less being produced than people want to purchase, and so on. So the equilibrium is that 45-degree line. Bedrock for Keynesian theory is that consumption equation, which says essentially that people will figure out ways to buy some consumption goods even when temporarily they're not earning an income. But the more they earn, the more they spend, but it has a slope less than one. Okay, they don't increase their consumption as much as the increase in their income. That's verbatim out of the general theory. That's the consumption equation. It has that form, C equals A plus BY. A, of course, is that vertical intercept, and B is the slope, which is less than one. And then we just pile on that investment spending. So that horizontal or vertical distance between C and C plus I is the amount of investment. It's independent of income. It is what it is, whatever investors decide they want to invest. Here it says it depends on expectations of the business community, which is not at all well anchored in economic reality. Okay, it's more of a psychological thing in Keynes's thinking, as we'll see. Notice that consumption and investment are lumped together. We don't have the PPF yet. We've got just C plus I as two kinds of expenditures. If we made it a mixed economy with government spending, of course, it'd be C plus I plus G. We just keep adding up expenditures. That's what matters in Keynes. And the two that we do have, consumption and investment, they're not distinguished in Keynesian theory because of their different function. In other words, investment is a means to an end, and consumption is the end. Okay, and that comes out pretty clear in the means-ends framework. But here, the two components are distinguished just by their stabilization characteristics. You know, where consumption is stable, not constant, but stable function of income, and investment is unstable because it's not well anchored in economic reality. You know, flip around quite a little bit. If we added government spending, it would be stabilizing in the Keynesian view. Hayek would have a different view of that, of course. Okay, and you can see it graphically. There's income, there's consumption, there's investment. So you can see that the economy is in equilibrium. Doesn't say anything about whether the economy is at full employment. In fact, a trick question on an exam that I might give, I don't give trick questions, but if I did, Keynesian equilibrium has to be where expenditures equals income, right? So suppose expenditures are zero and income is zero. Is the economy in equilibrium? Yeah. According to Keynes, it is. They're equal, right? They're usually equal at some higher level, but not necessarily full employment. Now, I just note here that, you know, we don't have any wage rates or interest rates or prices in the story. And so it's just movements in income. You just move along that income line one way or the other until you've got an equality between income and expenditure. The economy can spiral down to it or spiral up to it, whichever it needs to spiral, whichever way it needs to go in order to achieve full employment. Okay. It's only by accident or design that the economy is actually performing at its full employment potential. What's Keynes leaving out here? Accident, design, is there anything else? Yeah, there's just the invisible hand of Adam Smith or the spontaneous order by Hayek, the market at work with wages, prices, and interest rates automatically adjusting to its equilibrium level. That's what gets ruled out, only by accident or design. Designed, of course, means the policies of the government. But we're going to assume here, as it's common in the textbook, that we start out with the economy at full employment, if only by dumb luck. And even then, you probably won't be there for long because funny things happen with the Keynesian economies and they drop below full employment. Now, one way to show the full employment is to bring back our production possibilities frontier, all right? And we can look at that frontier and see whether the current level of consumption, current level of investment puts us on the frontier. And I've set up that PPF so that it does. I'm using a slightly bigger scale for investment here, but the investment horizontally here is supposed to be equal to the vertical distance between C and C plus I, so that we are at full employment. Now, Keynes would he would gauge full employment in a different way. What he would do, he would look at the level of income and take a look at the labor market. There's the labor market, supply and demand for labor. Boy, that looks pretty Marshallian. Look, that's micro stuff, isn't it? And yet Keynes has a different interpretation. Keynes says, okay, we got the supply of labor. We'll spot that to Marshall. That's the classical view of savings, upward sloping supply. But he says we're working with what he calls a going wage. So it's the wage rate that's given and the supply curve that's given. And then the burning question is, gee, are we just lucky enough that demand for labor is strong enough but not too strong so that it clears that labor market at the going wage? Okay, so it, and then that's, he said, it was just by accident or design that that would be true. But hey, it's true here, and we've already seen it as true in the PPF. So the economy really is at full employment at that point, okay? We can also note that income by Keynes is also measured in that diagram. Labor income is just the wage rate times the number of worker hours. And he treats that income as if it were total income. And he said, well, okay, you could think of labor income and then the labor equivalent of capital income or the labor equivalent of land rents or whatever. Or you could say that labor income moves up and down like the other factors. They all move up and down together. And so labor income is the biggest category. We'll just go with that, right? So he's not looking at relative shares between the different kinds of income. He's just looking at total income and letting labor income being a workable proxy for all of income. So why some FE? FE, for all you chemistry majors, means iron. But here it just means full employment, okay? That's full employment income. Okay. Now we'll bring back income equal expenditures. I have expenditures on the left of that circle. And it's all right, E equals Y. And let's see how this economy performs. According to Keynes, this is in one of the late chapters, the collapse in investment in chapter 22. A collapse in investment activity, the collapse being attributed to waning of animal spirits, is the primary cause of economic downturn. So his theory of depression is that investors are just overcome by pessimism. The animal spirits are on the wane, and they cut down investment. Now, I don't have an axis here for animal spirits, but there's one, okay? Okay, so that will cool the heels of any investor, okay? Animal spirits are on the wane, and what happens? Well, investment decreases, and there you show that as a fall in investment. And now you can see that no longer do we have Y equals C plus I. C plus I doesn't get you clear up to that old level. In fact, what you've got there is excess inventories that people cut back and things can't be sold, and those are excess inventories, all right? So that's not going to work. In fact, we can see it on the circular flow, too. E here is greater than Y. And so what happens, you have a piling up of inventories at the level of the firm, okay? There they are. Inventories are piling up. Excess inventories, you know, you can't even hold them. And so what happens? Well, the economy spirals down. The economy crashes. There it goes. down to a new level of equilibrium. And if you look at the labor market now, oh, here I'm going to show you that equation that formerly you all had to memorize and feed back the change in investment gives you a bigger change in income, and that particular relation is the so-called investment multiplier, which do the math and you get 1 over 1 minus B. So income goes down by more than investment went down by that factor. If B is 0.8, then the multiplier is 5. And we notice, too, that C goes down, too. Okay? Everything goes down. Investment goes down and consumption goes down. Let's look at labor. And what you have is a decrease in the demand for labor because they're not investing as much. They don't need the help. and that's a leftward shift of the demand curve. But the going wage keeps going even after the market conditions that gave rise to it are gone. All right? And you look at that diagram as it is now and think of the story I just told. This is called the general theory. The general theory. Well, how general is it? It really hinges on some very restrictive assumptions, doesn't it? Okay, I think you've gotten enough of that, and I can skip a few slides, which I think I'll do, and start with the morphing. I'm watching the clock, too, here. Morphing from the circular flow to means end. Can we do that? I think so. We start with that Keynesian cross. And then what we're going to do is carry that production possibilities frontier along with us. This will build a bridge between Keynesianism and Austrianism. Okay? We'll still track it with the Keynesian labor market as well. Now again, we're going to get the waning of the animal spirits. You don't get to see the ghost again, but waning of the animal spirit causes investment to decrease, and with it, income and consumption. Right? So this is the chapter 22, Waning of Animal Spirits. That chapter is called Notes on the Business Cycle, okay? Notes on the Trade Cycle. And you saw what happened before about the economy crashing with the Keynesian cross, but look at it this time in terms of the PPF. And we saw that both investment and consumption fell, all right? So I pulled the trigger here, and you get the economy caving in the interior of the PPF. So you've got unemployment, less consumption, and less investment. And again, Keynes is showing you that unemployment, all right? Now we have a further waning. It sends the economy deeper into the PPF's interior. Let's watch this. It's the same. We just fall deeper into the interior. But as you squint your eyes and look at this path that's being traced out on the PPF, you'll see that it's a linear path. It's a linear path. We can even show the equation for it. There we're even further in the dumper. Still, the wage rate hasn't changed. And in fact, you know, Keynes argued. He had three different arguments. One is that wages are sticky downward, so they don't change, or not at all readily. And the second argument is that, well, if they change, then things really get wild, so because prices change too, and he even said that prices and wages can spiral between zero and infinity without affecting anything, because they're spiraling at the same rate, so the real wage doesn't change. Okay, that's the second argument. And the third argument is that wage rates ought not to be allowed to change. The government should step in and make sure they don't change. Why is that? Well, because he'd say the wage rate's right. It's the correct wage rate. We're just short on demand. And if we can pump up the economy and get back to where full employment is, that wage rate will prevail once again. So don't let the wage rate fall. Then you're two steps away from full employment. Now you've got to get it back up and get demand up and get back to full employment. This is the general theory, right? So it turns out movements inside the frontier and beyond. Now, if you go beyond the frontier in Keynes, it's just inflation. In other words, you have real movements up to the frontier, and any movements beyond that are changes in prices and wages in the upward direction. The wages and prices are sticky downwards. They're not so sticky upwards, okay? So we'll put some other dots on there. Two you've already seen, one in the inflation. And then we can draw a line, put a line between them, okay? And just to show you that we've got the setup right, if investment were to fall to zero, then you'll be down there where consumption intersects with that 45-degree line, and that will correspond to that intercept in the right side diagram, isn't that right? Because that's where investment is zero. So I've got the curve, I've got the intercept right, I've got the slope right, right? And now all we need to do is spend a minute and a half showing you what that equation looks like. And it's something that you will recognize. The equilibrium condition is y equals c plus I. You got that in beginning macro. And consumption is c equals a plus by. And on an exam, I'm sure you've all taken this exam, you're given values for a and b, and you're given the level of investment, and you're asked to solve for equilibrium income. And boy, you go right at it, and you got equilibrium income. You can show right where that point is, okay? Well, fine, but you can do something else here. You've got two equations with three variables. You can eliminate any one of them. I'm going to eliminate income, and therefore I'll get the relationship implied by the Keynesian structure between investment and consumption. You let me do that? No, this is not in any textbook, okay? It's not in any textbook at any level. But it's the simplest thing in the world to do. So you can write, solve for C as some function of investment, and the easy way to do it is just plug in C plus I for Y and solve that, and I won't make you go through the steps, and I'll write it up above, you'll get an intercept of A over 1 minus B, which sure enough is the level of expenditures that you can derive also on the left side when there's no investment. And you can, and there's the equation, C equals some constant, A over 1 minus B, plus B over 1 minus B times investment. Now, B is less than 1, so 1 minus B is positive. And 1 over that is positive. So this says consumption and investment always move together. Okay, consumption and investment move together. They do it in ISLM too. Well, right there, you know you're in trouble, because if they always move together, there's no way you can trade off one against the other. All right? You have a quick question? Did you have a quick question, or you just... Well, yeah, and in fact, that might be done. But then you just move out along that upward sloping curve with a lot of inflation, and when Keynes, when Keynes said increase investment or increase government spending, he always meant with all the help in the world from the Federal Reserve. Okay. Okay, but let's save the questions. But that's a good one. I mean, you can see how that works. Now, here's what Keynes says about this. And he says it in the 37 article that was written a year after the general theory. And he simplifies it more. In the simplification, essentially, he assumes away the intercept term. And he assumes a B value of 0.9. And so from that, he says, for simplicity, let A equal 0, let B equal 0.9. That's my words. Then this demand constraint becomes C equals 0.9Y, all right? And here's what Keynes actually writes. He says, if, for example, the public are in the habit of spending 9/10 of their income on consumption goods, it follows that if entrepreneurs were to produce consumption goods at a cost more than 9 times the cost of investment goods they are producing, some part of the output could not be sold at a price which covers the cost of production. And essentially, if you boil that down, it means you got to be on that constraint. You got to be on that upward moving constraint. So he says the formula, of course, is not quite so simple as this. Well, yeah, because A is something, or the intercept is positive. But there is always a formula, more or less of this kind, an upward sloping line, relating the output of consumption goods, which it pays to produce, to the output of investment goods. This conclusion appears to me to be quite beyond dispute, if you're moving along that upward sloping line. Yet the consequences which follow from it are at the same time unfamiliar and of greatest possible importance. Well, what's unfamiliar today is the line itself. It doesn't show up in the textbook. I had it in there somewhere. I didn't see where that was. But I call that line the Keynesian demand constraint. And that's what I call it, because I can't look to see what other people call it, because no one even creates it, let alone call it something. But it's the demand constraint. In other words, the economy is constrained by aggregate demand. And so if it's constrained to move up and down along that line, then the PPF becomes out of play. And I've changed it to a dashed line. You're not going to be moving along the PPF. Sorry. Okay? Because the general theory says you are going up and down along that constraint. Okay. Now, let's keep track of the interest rate in a way that Keynes actually does. Of course, Keynes thought that neither saving nor, with trivial exception, investment is much affected by the rate of interest. So he would draw the two curves vertical. But he didn't object to drawing them this way if only you recognize that both curves shift together. And I'll show you how that works. So I'm going to draw the loanable funds market to fit what we've already got on the board, and the economy is now at full employment. Right? So Keynes couldn't object to that. He just doesn't have any capital theory. He didn't have a structure of productions. He's got a circular flow. All right? Though Keynes argued that neither saving or investment depend on the interest rate, okay, he didn't object to. And in fact, that's the curve, that's the diagram that he has in the general theory. And I'll show you the use that he made of it. So now with loanable funds in play, we see a decrease in investment is accompanied by a leftward shift in the demand for loanable funds. All right, so in other words, when I pull the trigger this time, now that investment's going to fall, but the demand for loanable funds falls right along with it. In fact, they don't demand the funds and they don't invest. Okay? So let's watch that. There they go, right? So they both fail. Now, if we had Hayek here, he would say, well, look Maynard, now there's downward pressure on interest rates. So the interest rate should fall. And Keynes would say, yes, Hayek, but before that can happen, something else happens. Can you guess what it is? The economy crashes. The economy spirals down. Okay, that sort of overrides any other market process. So when it spirals down, income falls, and guess what? So does saving, all right? Because saving is saving out of income. If income is lower, saving is lower. So now, spiraling downwards implies supply of loanable funds. That saving also shifts leftward, relieving the downward pressure on interest rates. So watch that. Okay. So the economy crashes like so. And there it is in the dumper again. Now, if you look at that diagram, that's not only the diagram that Keynes had in the general theory, but the point I'm making here is precisely the point that Keynes made in the general theory. He put it in there and says, look, savings falls right along with investment in that S&D diagram, and the interest rate doesn't change, so we don't need to bother about it. And out it goes, right? I can even show you that This appears in the general theory on page 180. There it is. Now, it's kind of a plunky diagram, I realize. Do any of you see the fundamental problem with that diagram just from starters? Just for starters? Huh? He didn't label the vertical axis. I've flunked students for lesson. But it turns out he's got R on the horizontal axis. That is the interest rate. Is British, you know, they're different. They say R for a rate of return. But it's the interest rate. That's what he's talking about. And as far as saving investment, he says what's on that vertical axis, measured vertically, investment and saving. So we'll save him from that, okay? All right. But now he's got the thing, the diagram cronkwise, right? Saving investment vertically. So what we need to do is flip it around and turn it 90 degrees. But we can do that. All right? So now it's pretty much like the diagram, except now he's got that saving thing sort of skewed the wrong way, but you know, that's part of having it cronkwise to start with. He didn't see how that needs to go. He's got some of, see, you see Y2, Y3, and so on. He's doing all those shifts just to argue that income is a shift parameter. When income changes, savings changes. And some of those shifts are just to show that. And so let's eliminate the ones that just show that. There they are. Now, we've got the diagram just exactly like the one on the PowerPoint, except for the wrong bowing of the supply curve. And he has it there to make the exact same point. In other words, he says if the demand for investment funds shifts left because people aren't investing as much now because of animal spirits, then saving shifts left too because income spirals down and saving goes with it. And in the end, you've got the same interest rate, all right? So that's justification for not even worrying about the interest rate. It doesn't change, okay? And so out with the interest rate. You could do on the left there, you could put the same, locate the same points. And that's what I'm talking about. It's just I've cleaned it up on the right, flipped it around where you can see the similarity. Now look at that right-hand diagram now, and then let's switch back to here and see it's that same diagram, exactly the same, to make exactly the same point. So we're dead on with Keynes as far as getting the right interpretation. Someone can accuse us as, oh, you're misinterpreting Keynes. No, absolutely not. Okay. Now, I want to move closer to Hayek here by recognizing that Hayek usually talked about a change in saving. People become more thrifty. Keynes didn't talk about that because he said they don't become more thrifty. They're creatures of habit. They spend on the basis of current income and nothing else. Okay? But suppose they do. In fact, Keynes supposed they do. He says a good thing they don't change because, he wrote down here, every attempt to save more by reducing consumption, that's how you save more, by the way, will so affect income, in other words, you spiral down, that the attempt necessarily defeats itself. In other words, you save more, income goes down, saving goes down. Hey, you tried to save more, but it came back down. And so in trying to save more, this is the paradox of thrift, of course. Oh, I did that prematurely, because let me show you. If you show a decrease in consumption, that's an increase in saving, then, of course, that C line will shift. C plus I will go down, too, because I is just piled on top of C. Even the demand constraint now will go down because the intercept is A over 1 minus B. And saving in the bottom diagram will shift outward because you're saving more. Okay, so if you're saving more, consuming less, and the intercept changes, too. It's a lot of changes. But what should happen? Okay. Now, once again, we can bring in Hayek and say, you've just about got it, Maynard. Look, there's downward pressure on interest rates. Interest rate will fall to that new equilibrium. Credit will be cheaper. investors will undertake more long-term projects and have goods ready for savers at the time they're trying to spend those saved up funds. Okay, you got it right. And what does Keynes say? He says, well, Hayek, before that can happen, something else happens. Have you all got that part? You know what else happens? What is it? The economy crashes. And when it crashes, then saving falls back. In other words, that saving, it shifts out because of a preference change. It comes back because income went down. All right? So let's watch that. I'm just showing you I've got my demand constraint lined up right. So let's watch that. Okay. And that of course, is paradox of thrift. To save more, try to save more and you'll just end up earning less. And saving may be the same amount as before. And the economy is in the dumper. Okay? Now we're going to resolve the paradox. And it turns out resolving that paradox of thrift, that's key as far as the debate between Keynes and Hayek goes. To resolve that paradox of thrift requires that we switch from that circular flow construction to the means-ends construction. And then it will require that we relax three Keynesian assumptions. Right. Now let's see. I think we need to reset. Yeah. So that's the level of consumption right there. Okay. And of course, that's the consumption that is the final output of the last stage of the Hayekian triangle. So I can superimpose here a Hayekian triangle. There's one. All right. And I'm going to get rid of the C plus I plus G or C plus I. Right. So I've outfitted it now with a means-ends framework instead of a circular flow framework. And still, though, I'm going to keep the Keynesian vision. Keep the Keynesian vision. And what that amounts to is if you look at the labor income, for instance, I think that comes next, look at the full employment, and now we've got still a single labor market, but it applies to all of the different stages of production. It works the same in all of them. And justifiably so in his own terms, because the interest rate doesn't change, and so you don't get this differential interest rate sensitivity. So the interest rate's not even changing. Right? So that's the model we're working with now. And of course, if we get then an increase in saving, the paradox will still play itself out. We get that shift out rightward, but the economy will spiral down. And watch that Hayekian triangle. Keynes talked about those excess inventories. He says, well, those excess inventories will just ripple all through the system because he doesn't have any offsetting interest rate change that would raise demand in the early stages. And so he just has underutilization of the capital structure, right? And besides, in one of his early chapters, chapter 4, he assumed, it was one of his assumptions, he assumed a fixed structure of industry, which means, of course, fixed structure of production. It means that the shape of that triangle doesn't change. Now, essentially what he's saying is that his analysis of the business cycle is over a short enough period that we can justifiably assume no change in the structure of industry. But boy, that change is crucial to explaining the business cycle. Okay. And so now you have just unemployment among the people, among the labor force, because you've got an underused capital structure. Okay. Now we come in for the hardcore morphing, and it goes something like this. That's Keynes, okay? That's Keynes, because you've got a single labor market. So we need three modifications to transform the Keynesian vision into the Hayekian vision. And as I read through these relaxations of assumption. Just raise your hand if you object to relaxing one of those assumptions. Okay. One is, let's divide the structure into stages. Don't just assume it's all one structure that it can't change. Well, that's easy to do. Divide it into stages like that. Okay. Second assumption, allow for stage-specific labor markets in which wage rates adjust to changes in market conditions, which would be changes to, you know, you'd have differential interest rate sensitivities then. Can we do that? Yeah, let's just outfit the economy with different labor markets. Let's show again two, one for lower stage. And is there anything else? Oh, yeah, look. If those labor markets can have labor go from one to the other and we got different stages of production, that means the triangle can change in shape, and that means you can move along the frontier. You can move along the PPF. So the demand constraint in Keynes is no longer binding. And so the third one, get rid of the Keynesian demand constraint. Okay. How do you do that? Watch. It's sort of a feel-good slide there, okay? Now, anybody object to any of those three assumptions? And yet, when you make those three assumptions, you've got the Austrian model. You've got Hayek, okay? And so now, we're going to have time for questions, I tell you. I better slow down if I don't want to answer questions. But paradox of thrift becomes a gateway for growth. Now, that's a little bit hyperbole or whatever, but with wage rates and the interest rate both adjusting to changes in market conditions, the economy can move along the PPF. And the structure of production can adjust to an increase in saving. Okay? And we could watch it. There's an increase in saving, and so you got no demand constraint to change. And you get a shift, you get the Austrian view. So now we've gone, here's what Keynes, his summary criticism of Keynes. Mr. Keynes's aggregates conceal the most fundamental mechanisms of change. He actually issued that in response to Keynes's general theory, but it applies in spades Keynes's treatise on money, I should have said. When you get to the general theory, this applies all the more. Okay. And we saw just how that is. There, through it, okay. Okay, thank you very much.